modern-fabrics.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, battleground state North Carolina continues to act as a magnet for candidates and their surrogates. Donald Trump lays out a new deal for African Americans in Charlotte. Hillary Clinton comes to town to talk to college students at UNC Charlotte. And Bill, the president and first lady, combed the state for votes. Polls say the governor's race is tightening with Pat McCrory gaining on Roy Cooper. Charlotte takes another hit because of HB 2, losing over 700 jobs to Richmond, Virginia, and the Keith Scott shooting continues to echo through city government. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn and Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. They do this on purpose. Gwendolyn Glenn and Glenn Burr. They do it on purpose to me. Welcome back. Good to
Thank
see you.
Eric
with a K. Eric Spanberg is here, senior writer, staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. And Eric with a C, Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, is also here. Good morning. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Let's begin with Donald Trump. He was in Charlotte in this building on Wednesday afternoon to speak to a private gathering here at Spirit Square. Who did he speak to?
Well, he spoke to – first, he had a group of African-Americans, a small group of African-Americans that he spoke with, and then he spoke to a larger group that was mostly white about his new plan for African-American neighborhoods. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but yeah, it was interesting how you phrased the question because that was like a trick question.
Yeah, it was. That's why I was stumped. That's why I was very carefully trying to navigate my way through that.
Who did he speak about?
Yeah.
Right.
And who those – I think it was maybe only about 8 African Americans he spoke to
Correct.
Initially.
Yes,
and
that's enough.
I don't know exactly who they were, but then too, his speech, he was talking about what he was going to do in terms of African Americans, but they were not in that bigger audience.
Right, and I think there were a lot of campaign volunteers who were part of the audience, okay. the larger audience yeah. that he spoke to.
And the media was invited.
Yes, the media was
invited. So he laid out what he called a new deal for black Americans, saying, I will be your greatest champion. And, of course, reiterated the fact that he believes that Hillary Clinton and the Democrats have used African Americans and taken them for granted over the years. And I guess, I don't know whether he said, what do you got to lose again or not, but he said that in the past. How was this received in the black community?
I think most African Americans have written off Donald Trump. He's not polling very well at all. I haven't read anything or talked to anyone who took those proposals very seriously. You know, the problem is he spent this entire campaign, saying things to offend various groups, and now in the 11th hour, he comes with what might have been a serious proposal a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, it's just way too late.
I mean, I've seen some African-American commentators, pundits on television say that though there are people in the African-American community who are insulted by this because he paints this picture of the ghetto as being a violent, dangerous, hopeless place where people's lives are just abjectly bad. And they recoil at that because it's simply not true, and it's as though there are no white or Hispanic poor people living in a ghetto.
Yeah, and on top of that, he frames it as if that's the only place black people
exactly.
live in the ghetto.
Right.
And
he actually
had a slip of the tongue recent, I think it was yesterday, where he has avoided using the word ghetto, but he accidentally said it, and that he kind of like caught himself like, oops, that's not
there
how
was,
I'm supposed to
there
say
There was it. A very paternalistic line in there in his Charlotte speech where he said, I think it was, every poor black child should be able to feel safe. You know, there's this notion that only I or people that are aligned with me can come in and fix this. And to me, that sounds very tone deaf. By the way, we should also mention he has zoomed from 0% to 4% yeah. among African Americans.
Well, I mean, it may be tone deaf, but let's give the man the benefit of the doubt here. I mean, let's just say he's genuine about this. And if he is genuine, he may be misinformed about where African Americans live and or how they live. But he says he wants to do something for him. He says he will push for tax holidays. holidays for inner-city investment, new tax incentives for foreign companies to relocate in, quote, blighted American neighborhoods. Is his heart in the right place?
Well, people I've
talked
to... Would
that be helpful, too?
People I've talked to do not feel that he's sincere and that the things that he's talking about, that he's very out of touch, that they do not... The majority of African-Americans say... We don't live in these kinds of communities and in these areas that he's describing, and he's not talking to me, and feel that he's not being sincere and just making a last-ditch effort to now all of a sudden try to reach out to African-American voters.
Let's also look at context here, Mike. I mean, the man is 70 years old.
Right.
Both he and his father have gone to court over discriminating against potential residents and tenants, and all through his political campaign the past year and a half, 2 years, up until, a month ago, he didn't talk about African-American neighborhoods, economic issues, or anything else until all of a sudden we get late in the campaign.
Yeah, my thing with this whole question is, if he really were sincere about trying to engage the African-American community, specifically the people who live in the inner cities that he's always talking about, he would be talking to people, the people who were in the streets after Keith Scott. And that's a tough conversation. And he's not trying to have that conversation. If you were serious about this, those are the people you need to be talking to.
But more
those
than that, he turned down an invitation to speak with the NAACP.
He turned down
an invitation to speak at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention. You can't say that you're serious about making proposals for the African-American community and not speak to them.
So prior to talking to campaign workers and whomever else was in the audience at the McGlohan Theater here at Spirit Square, he spoke backstage with eight African Americans. Who were they? How were they chosen? What did he talk to them about? Do we know? And what was their reaction? Do we know?
I know one of the people that was there had worked with him, I think, on the television show.
Omarosa.
That's Omarosa. Yeah.
Right. But I don't know how they...
But they were local. Eight local.
Yeah, I don't know how they chose the eight local people.
I haven't seen anywhere the names were,
and we've
published.
Heard nothing from these
who
people.
They were.
Why not, do you suppose? Was it?
I know the last event that he had in Charlotte where he was specifically trying to go to the black community was at this African-American church that I can't remember the name of. I suspect it was probably... folks from that church. Again.
So as Eric Spanberg mentioned a moment ago, Trump's support among the African-American community is about 4%. It's been there for a while now. What possible impact could this speech, this meeting with the eight African-Americans in Charlotte backstage at the McGlohan Theater have on his campaign and his chances for president at this point in time?
Here's what I think he's really doing or trying to do. I think he's trying to just muddy the waters for Hillary Clinton's support among the black community just by making the broad, overtures to the black community saying, hey, I care about you guys. I care about you guys. Those guys just they take your vote for granted. Why do you support them? What have you gotten for all these years of supporting them? I think and also there was this story in I think it was Bloomberg Business Week just yesterday in which they quoted some people from the Trump campaign anonymously saying that voter suppression was a part of what they're doing because they know that they aren't getting the level of support from Republicans and suburban whites that they need. So they're, the alternate strategy is bring down the level of support for your opponent, and that's African-Americans, liberal whites, college-educated
women.
And at the risk of patting myself on the back, I wrote that several weeks ago when Donald Trump first started talking about African-American voters, that and pundits and people in the African-American community were trying to figure out what's this man's strategy. And I said, his strategy is as much about keeping blacks at home as it is about winning their votes. I don't think he fools himself that he can actually win the vote, but for every African-American he can convince the Democrats of taking them for granted and he can keep at home, it's just as good as a vote.
Yeah.
Well,
and that comes at a time when you have Clinton and Bill Clinton as well and Kaine coming out and going around the state saying, vote early to get the vote out. And again, that Bloomberg article said that that is what he's trying to do to get people to stay at home.
Mm-hmm. And then the flip, of course, is interesting. Bill Clinton was – he was in the eastern part of the state, and he said, Southerners of my generation know what Make America Great Again really means. That Trump is speaking in racial code. So you can see there is this sort of race war between the two candidates here in the final stages of the campaign.
Hillary Clinton was here in town this week. She was a part of a Sunday rally outdoors at UNC Charlotte and came back to the state yesterday with Michelle Obama to appear at Wake Forest University. Obviously, she's making a play for college students because when she spoke at UNC Charlotte, I believe, she talked about a free tuition, which we'll talk about. But I have a question about the strategy here. She's talking to college students, many of whom have to vote absentee. We're less than 2 weeks out. Is this a waste of time? I mean, if they have to vote absentee, it ain't going to happen.
I think there's a time that the ballot has to be postmarked. We're probably getting pretty close to that.
So it's possible if you live someplace else and you're a student at UNC Charlotte or at Wake Forest, you could say, I've seen her. I like what she says. I'm going to
vote. Not only that, you go home on the weekend. You know,
not if you live in Nebraska.
Yeah, but most, I mean, I think if you look at UNCC, for example, I mean, most students are probably from somewhere in North Carolina. So ostensibly, they could go home to, you know, wherever, Greensboro.
Well, a lot are from Charlotte.
So. Right, a lot are from Charlotte. That's a good point.
I think they have to be postmarked maybe like 3 days ahead of the actual election day or something like that, but I'm not sure.
So yesterday in Winston-Salem was Michelle Obama's first appearance with Hillary Clinton on the stump, and Hillary Clinton spoke first and left the cleanup for Michelle Obama, who's brilliant, by the way. She's just brilliant. That's interesting to me because usually the candidate speaks last. The last speaker is the star.
I think that was just a bow to the reality, the fact that Michelle Obama was the draw.
Would you want to follow Michelle Obama at this point? I think that is the right thing to do. I mean, it looks like if certainly Democrats had their druthers, Michelle Obama would be at the top of the table.
Why is it taking so long for the first lady to be on the stump with the candidate?
Well, this is not a particularly political first lady. I mean, that's the first thing to remember. She is not a big fan of going out and – I mean, she said she doesn't like campaigning particularly. She doesn't want to be out making speeches over and over.
She's so good at it.
Well, and that's the funny part is whenever she does do it, she's very, very effective. And you saw that again in Winston-Salem yesterday.
Mm-hmm. And I think there was probably something strategic about it as well. You really want to hold your big guns until the last.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I – hear that she is going to make herself even more available, and she's going to be out there even more. And she brings that personal touch. She's a dynamic speaker, and I think she connects with people in a way. I mean, you'll hear her saying things like, vote for my girl. She is qualified, and then she'll get into, but she talks even in a language, very professional, but she talks in a way that people can connect, and I think that's something that we all said and heard and read, that Hillary is missing that personal touch, and she definitely adds
that. Well, it's interesting, because Hillary Clinton is among the most unliked people ever to run for the office, as is Donald Trump. I think they are the two most disliked people. On the other hand, Michelle Obama is one of the most popular people in the country. Period. So when you have these two polar opposites on the same stage at the same time, the most popular in favor of the least popular, that's an interesting dynamic. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more. We'll talk about the governor's race. And believe it or not, we're going to talk about HB2 again. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Elon University, opening the new School of Communications facilities with two broadcast studios, HD theater, and several media innovation labs. Details at elon.edu. Well, she has one of the most recognizable voices in the world. Well, certainly on public radio. She came to public consciousness on This American Life, has since appeared with David Letterman, Jon Stewart, Conan O'Brien, and in the film The Incredibles. Her voice may be her calling card, but words are her bread and butter. She's the author of 6 nonfiction books on American history and culture. Have you guessed who it is yet? Sarah Vowell. Sarah Vowell will tell her story when we meet on this program Monday in a conversation we recorded last night at Lenoir Rhine University. Sarah Vowell, Monday at 9, right here.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The presidential race tightens as Florida and Nevada move back to battleground status. Republicans turn their focus to down-ballot races, and some Affordable Care Act premiums are set to rise sharply next year.
The News Roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon following Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup here with Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News. Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. And Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Back to Hillary Clinton, who was in town this week at UNC Charlotte. Sounded a bit like Bernie Sanders talking about plans to make college tuition free for students from families earning less than $125,000 a year. Bernie Sanders, of course, made great inroads with the promise of that and talking about the ridiculous amount of student debt that's out there. A lot of people have yet to be enamored of Hillary. Is that why she's talking about this? Can she make this happen?
Well, I think certainly she has been pushed much farther left than she would have been by Bernie Sanders. And this is one of the reasons I think that Hillary Clinton is disliked by so many. She's not the first politician or the last to be rather elastic in her views. But certainly in this campaign, she has really gone far away from her centrist to conservative Democratic ethos. And so I don't know whether she can do it. I think that if you assume the polls are right and Hillary Clinton is the next president, the first thing to watch is how resistant is the Republican Congress. You would maybe assume Democrats will have the Senate, but they're not going to have the House most likely. So do they see any need, or do they have any willingness to go along with some of these plans like Hillary's talking about?
And I think a lot just depends on how the election actually plays out and what, how many seats the Republicans wind up losing, assuming they do, whether they lose the Senate. A lot of that will, I think, dictate the mood they're in towards her.
But I think we might have gotten an early bellwether. Ted Cruz this week said that, hey, we have a long history of the Supreme Court not being fully staffed,
true,
so to speak.
But if they get completely slaughtered come November 8th, he'll back away from that.
I think she'll have a hard time getting it implemented, but I can certainly understand why she's doing it. The young people, college students, played a big role in getting Barack Obama elected.
Right.
And as the father of with a daughter in grad school, I can tell you, student debt is huge. And if you can appeal to these young people who are in college or struggling with student debt that we're going to do something about this, that has to be a winning message.
Well, Hillary Clinton has been to Charlotte five times, I believe, in this election cycle. Donald Trump has been here four times. In a story in The Observer on October 23rd, the paper reported that Real Clear Politics' average of polls had Clinton leading Trump 47% to 44.2% in North Carolina. But yesterday, in that same aggregation of polls, Clinton led Trump by only 2 points, 45.8% to 43.8%. Those numbers are small, but she's losing ground. What's going on here?
Well, I think that you can look at any number of different polls and kind of come up with different conclusions. But I think everything generally shows her to have kind of a small and tenuous, but it's been fairly consistent lead in North Carolina. One thing I've been watching. It's the New York Times has this really interesting daily early vote tracker of North Carolina.
Is it 92 to 8
and
now?
Yeah. Yes. Well, this one's specifically about the early votes that are coming in North Carolina, and kind of they take the actual early vote and then somehow blend that in with their polling and project ahead.
Right.
And what they're seeing from the early vote, 968,000 people have voted already out of about 4.4 million that they think will eventually vote. And right now they're projecting Hillary Clinton a six-point win for her, 6 percentage points, 49 to 43, which if that actually comes to pass, would A, be bad news for somebody like Richard Burr, because he'd really need a significant amount of, you know, vote ticket splitting to happen for him to survive Deborah Ross.
I noticed that the Republicans are the first on the ballot in every race in North Carolina. They're first, and the Democratic candidate is second. Why is that?
Well, probably doesn't hurt to, you know, control the levers of power at the State Board of Elections, Republicans do.
And you mentioned Richard Burr. In the race for U.S. Senate, Real Clear Politics yesterday showed a definite lead by Richard Burr over Deborah Ross, 45.4 to 42.2. The Civitas poll in October shows Burr ahead 45 to 37%. He's ahead 49 to 43% in the Monmouth poll, which is done out of New Jersey. What the hell do they know about us? But she is only
it's all phones.
She is only ahead. Deborah Ross is only ahead, and by 1 point in the New York Times poll. Is that race over, or are you saying there's hope yet for Deborah Ross?
Yeah, I think she's within shouting distance.
Really?
And if
despite all those numbers I just read?
Yeah, I think – but here's what – you take those numbers – and if you have a 6 percentage point win in North Carolina by Hillary Clinton, remember Barack Obama barely won
14,000 votes, which
was 14,000
in
North Carolina in 08. And then in 2012, he barely lost it. So a 6 percentage point win by a Democrat in North Carolina would say that, you know, that would say that we are having a pretty significant, I wouldn't use the word seismic shift, but there's something big going on.
If that happened, you would think that would lift the bottom of the ticket.
Yeah.
The other thing that, of course, all of us are wondering about, not only in North Carolina but across the country, is so what are people doing in terms of a Republican goes in and maybe doesn't vote for Trump but does vote for the rest of – you know, now there is much less ticket splitting than there was in years past. That's what the experts tell us, but this is an unusual top of the ticket. So,
well, the New York Times has endorsed Ross, and from what I've read, most even though those polls are showing her not ahead, it's still saying that it's a toss-up. Mm-hmm. That in most where I've read that they are still saying she has a chance, and that there's a lot of surprise that she's doing as well as she is doing. That no one expected her, you know, early on for her to be doing this well, but it's being called a toss-up.
Meanwhile, I looked at polls yesterday in the governor's race because evidently Pat McCrory is making a comeback here.
Carolina comeback, he would call it.
Yeah, exactly right. The last polls I saw had them both in a statistical tie. The Monmouth poll shows the governor with a 1-point lead over the Attorney General. A late poll by Civitas showed voters favoring Pat McCrory over Roy Cooper by 46 to 42%. When asked if the election were held today, who would you vote for? Would you say that's because the fallout from HB2 has been eclipsed by what the governor has done as the chief emergency officer of the state because of Hurricane Matthew and the flooding down east?
Oh, no doubt. Matthew, as you know, it sounds weird to say it, but Matthew has helped him. I mean, you've got a situation where he's on air in the eastern part of the state doing good things and being, you know, showing leadership. He even has a commercial now, if you've seen it, out about leadership, you know, that he's been taking charge of, you know, this situation in North Carolina's moment of need. You know, he's been there showing leadership. And what has Roy Cooper been doing? You know,
and
kind of thing.
And so, this is a very typical thing when you have some kind of natural disaster or crisis that immediately politicians want to take advantage of it. And you do get some benefit for, by all accounts, it seems like the state has handled this pretty well. We haven't heard, we haven't heard anything like what happened with Katrina, for example. So I do think he's getting some bounce from it. I think what's going to be interesting is, what are we, 10 days out? You have that going on, the Matthew impact, and now this week HB2 arose again with this company that didn't relocate to Charlotte. So how
nice
do those two things play?
What a nice segue, because that's where we're going next, HB2, because we can't let a week go by without talking about HB2. We're still feeling the pain here in Charlotte, even though there are people who say we don't feel any pain from this. This week, CoStar, that's the name of the of the company, CoStar Group, it's a real estate research firm, whatever that is, announced that they had chosen Richmond, Virginia over Charlotte to locate their research operations center. It's a loss of 730 of the kinds of jobs that Charlotte says it wants to attract, and a loss of a promise to invest $250 million into our economy here in Charlotte. These all would have been new hires. They're not bringing anybody in from anywhere else. They would have hired people from the Charlotte region to take these jobs. The average pay was, I think, $56,000, ranging as high as $171,000. Put this loss into perspective. Is this a big deal?
Well,
that's
it depends.
A big deal.
Yeah, I think it's a big deal, but I also think it's in the eye of the beholder. So many things. I mean, State Senator Bob Rucho, Republican from Mecklenburg County, called me to speak about this story after our real estate reporter wrote this, and I guess he thought I wrote it. But anyway, he immediately said, look, it's a $500 billion state economy. We're talking about maybe $500 million worth of business and jobs that have been lost because of HB2. So it's a drop in the bucket. So I'm not saying that. I'm just
saying. So we don't care. Is that what he's saying? We don't care.
In essence, what he's saying is it's such a small percentage. We'd like to have everything, but we know we can't have everything. So that is what HB2 supporters are saying. And obviously, on the other side, it's not just the money and the jobs, but, for example, the Charlotte Chamber CEO told me yesterday, it's the perception. It's what people all across America think when they hear that yet another company or another event has left or boycotted North Carolina because of HB2. So that's where we are in that same stalemate.
Well, you hear McCrory's people talking about that this is not a big deal because, of course, when PayPal was coming here, oh, that was great, wonderful. And now it's like, oh, it wasn't such a big deal. So when these things happen, it's the spin that they put on it is you know, of course, they're going to say that. And that's what you're hearing. But then you hear some developers saying that for every one company that comes, 10 are not coming because of HB2.
And well, I would call that spin. It really is. We're talking about 700 people, not just jobs. We're talking about people. Many of whom, or some of whom, might be unemployed now, and there's a multiplying effect. Mm-hmm. People get jobs, they spend money, they buy cars, they go to museums, they go on vacations. It doesn't end with just the employment number.
Right. According to a report in the Observer, CoStar walked away from about $8.3 million in tax incentives to locate in Virginia. They're only getting $4 million in Virginia. So this. This means, I guess this, you tell me, you're the business reporter, this means that they made this decision not based on business practices or good bottom line business. They did this because they have a belief that discrimination is wrong.
Yeah, I mean, and everything would tell you that. The company stopped just short of saying HB2, but they did say they're committed to diversity and so on and so forth. So everything points to HB2, including the real estate broker who was showing them around Charlotte, who immediately pointed to HB2 as the cause of this lost business. So I don't know how you – I gave you the opinion or the line of what HB2 supporters are saying, but I don't know how you can sort of overcome the plain, cold, hard facts of lost jobs and lost revenue. It's very difficult to say that doesn't matter.
And I think the fact that this company went somewhere else for half the tax benefit, I mean, that – speaks to the damage to the state's brand and the real impact that's going on here. I mean, this particular case is just another reminder that the legislature has to do something about HB2.
Well, maybe not, because although this decision was announced after this comment, Commerce Secretary John Skvarla said that HB2's business impact isn't anything to worry about. It hasn't moved the needle one iota.
And he said that this week in Charlotte. I mean, it's not like he said that 6 months ago. He said that this week.
We have an economic mobility task force that's doing some work right now. Eric and I yesterday, we were at an event where another organization announced a new group called One Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And part of their focus, I'm sure, will be good-paying jobs. You know, just to say that this is insignificant, it might be insignificant from a big-picture standpoint, But when we're talking about lifting the lives of individuals, it's really insulting to say that 700 middle-class jobs is insignificant. It's never insignificant to people who are looking for work or people right. who are trying to lift themselves up.
Mm-hmm. I'm being told in the reason that the Republican candidates are being listed first on the ballot is that state law says candidates and parties are listed. They decide who's going to be listed first based on whose nominee for governor received the most votes in the most recent gubernatorial election. So that's why. Let's talk about CMS. Let's get off of HB2. We've talked enough about HB2 on this program to last a lifetime, I think. It's less than 2 weeks before CMS decides on its new magnet plan, and at Tuesday's school board meeting, Ann Clark said she only plans for the board to vote on November the 9th for magnet expansions at 9 schools in the coming school year. Not years gone, but not years out, but just next year, 2017-18. Was that always the plan?
Well, from my understanding, it was, and that was one thing that some people who testified at that hearing said they were concerned about, because they said they wanted to have more time to digest this and come up with a plan B, or to talk with their communities collectively and see, okay, they are planning to do this. And parents said it would give them time to plan as well in terms of their children. So one board member, and I'm trying to remember who, said that was a concern, that we're only looking at next school year and mm-hmm. not years down the road. So that was an issue brought up when the board talked.
Is that because we're about to get a new superintendent? So why plan for years down the road when he or she may want to change things?
Well, one of the things they said, that a lot of things are still fluid, that the discussions are still going on, and it sounds as if a lot of this, they don't know what they plan to do. They have some ideas. They haven't identified funding, they said, and so they're still kind of deciding, discussing where a lot of these pieces are going to come together.
So they're going to vote in 2 weeks, and I believe that Tuesday was the first opportunity, correct me if I'm wrong, for the public to chime in on this new plan. You were there. Does it seem odd to you that this was the first opportunity? And it won't be that many more between now and the time they vote.
They have had a lot of community meetings, and I've attended some of those. They've had them in different schools. Some have been lightly attended. Some had 200 or more people who came out. But, yes, this was the first public hearing. And I think one thing that was surprising with that public hearing is that, you know, this plan is to try to bring some balance in terms of the diversity of these magnet schools, in terms of income, in terms of race. You have some schools that there is no kind of balance there. So it's to try to make these schools more diverse. And I think they were expecting people to talk more about that, but what parents and students talked about were their specific schools. Geringer High School had probably, of the 30 people, about half were parents and students from Geringer. You had parents from the Marie G. Davis Military School, which the plan is calling for that school to merge with Hawthorne. One is a military school and a magnet. And
they're pretty far apart.
And they are about a little over 7 miles apart. So one parent told me that, yes, she was concerned that the commute is going to be longer. But they were also concerned about whether or not they would have distinct programs and if those programs would be preserved. So, yes, they were concerned. And then the East Side residents, they were concerned. They were saying, we don't have any magnets planned for the East Side at all. So Geringer wanted to become a magnet.
We'll talk more about this magnet situation when we come back from the break, and also about the Keith Scott shooting that's still reverberating through the halls of government. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls, serving patients in their home or workplace. All insurance accepted. Registration information available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Never wait in a doctor's office again. Well, the weekly news roundup continues with the National Hour on the Diane Rehm Show. The presidential race tightens as Florida and Nevada move back to the battleground status. Republicans turn their focus to down-ballot races, and some Affordable Care Act premiums are set to rise sharply next year. Journalists will join Diane Rehm coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock for the National Hour, the International Hour at 11. And if you'd like to chime in on the local hour, well, now's your chance. Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. We're coming right back.
Republicans, Democrats, independents, beer lovers, and news junkies. Join WFAE for an election night results watching party at Free Range Brewing on North Davidson Street. The party starts at 7 p.m. on Election Day, November 8th. We'll listen to and watch coverage from WFAE's news department, NPR, and PBS as the polls close. Information at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, where it's the local news roundup with Gwendolyn Glenn, reporter for WFAE News, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Let's go back to CMS, and you were at that meeting on Tuesday night, Gwendolyn. There were some parents who were worried, I'm told, that there would be unintended consequences trying to diversify these magnet schools and base them on socioeconomic statistics of parents, et cetera. Did the board have an answer for these unintended consequences that these folks were worried about?
Well, the board spoke separately. You know, they had the public hearing, and one parent did talk about that in terms of you're going to pull students from all of these other homeschools for these magnet schools, and what's going to happen, and then maybe there'll be some shift with magnet schools, and there was a fear that as these schools are losing students, they might also lose funding. They could lose teachers. They could lose actual classes and programs. And the board didn't talk specifically about that, but there was some Mary McCray, the board president, said that for some people there was no wow factor with this.
What does that mean? I saw that.
Yeah, she said that. Well, she was specifically talking about the east side, because when they were saying that we don't have enough magnets here, we have a partial magnet in this plan, we don't have a full magnet program, and they felt they were being left out. So she said, if somebody on the east side, you don't see the wow factor to go out and really support this, because what's in it for you?
One change in the program that did come up was the idea being floated about lowering entry requirements to get into these magnet schools, and some were concerned that doing that would lower the quality of those programs, and yet Superintendent Ann Clark said no, that wouldn't happen. How so?
She said it wouldn't happen because she said that what they wanted to do was to open up these magnet programs to more students who might have been left out because of some of these entrance requirements, higher levels of math, for instance, for STEM programs, or higher level of language for some of the language programs. And she said the thing is that the programs themselves would not, the quality would not go down, because the students, okay, you're in, and what you're going to have to do is to be successful in order to stay in. So she said that there would be.
So are they setting these kids up for failure? If you lower the requirements to get in and you let more people in who are not ready for that magnet, and then you have to pass the test, and you got to be as good as the people who could have got in under the higher standards, are you setting these kids up for failure?
According to them, they'll be taking courses that would help them to pass those exams, and that some of the schools are doing some of the work that you have in these magnet schools. So they're thinking that a lot of students who people look at and said, you can't make it in these programs, that they are capable. And once they get in, take these courses, that they will get up to speed and, you know, don't want to look and say, no, you are not qualified, to give them a chance.
Okay. So November the 9th is the day the school board meets again to vote on the actual magnet.
Exactly.
The reverberations over the Keith Scott shooting continue. CMPD Police Chief Kerputney is urging the community to work with police as it addresses concerns raised in the aftermath of that fatal shooting. What did he mean by that? Work with police in what way?
I think what he, and I kind of hesitate to speak for him because I haven't actually been able to speak with him, but I think what he's been saying is that the police recognize that they need a broader sort of cooperation and a spirit of cooperation with the community. And what they found during the unrest after the Scott shooting was that there were a lot of people who did not trust the police's motives. I mean, you still have a lot of people who think that Justin, what's his last name?
Carr.
Justin Carr was shot by a police officer, despite the fact that police officers, that the police department keeps insisting that, no, it so was this there, guy that we arrested.
Isn't there video of that? Didn't they find him because of
that's
video?
That's what they say, but they have not released that video. Yeah. That's a part of the case, they say.
Well, the president's task force, this is the president of the United States task force, made recommendations for things that need to be addressed quickly, like training and tactics, cultural proficiency, education, and body cameras. But after that task force made their recommendations, Chief Putney emphasized the need for people to comply with local, with lawful commands from police to de-escalate the situation. His words were comply, communicate, and de-escalate.
He kept saying de-escalate a lot.
Is that what he means by work with police? Do what you're told?
I think he means two things. I think he means that, but I think he's also he and others at the police department have talked a lot about improving training, cultural recognition, and I guess to put it plainly, restoring trust between the police department and minorities in particular. So they do acknowledge that, but I think people heard that de-escalate and comply and immediately said, well, wait a minute, this isn't
particularly. And also you had Al Austin, who sits on the city council, who immediately said that sounds like submit, and that that comes off very negative for a lot of people in the community when you say comply.
I think the chief is trying to walk, because I know we've heard him speak very eloquently and insightfully about this issue in the past, just not only as a police chief, but also as a black man in America. So I think he understands the dimensions of the problem and the depth of the problem, but when he says things like that, I always think, okay, he's trying to reflect also and walk this sort of line between what his officers feel and what
his
officers want said and what he knows needs to be done. And it's a tough act,
I imagine. Could it also be that words don't exist right now for what needs to happen, this fine line that needs to be walked on his side of the equation and for what's being heard on the other side of the equation in the community? There's words that just don't exist.
Yeah.
I think to some degree he's still dealing with the Randall Carrick issue. His predecessor was very quick to charge the officer with, I think it was manslaughter, whatever the case was. And while the public, or a large part of the public, applauded that decision, it wasn't popular at all, as you might imagine, with the officers on the street.
Well, and I think he even said, didn't he, there are deep divisions within the force.
Exactly.
He said that, yes.
Well, that brings up the mayor, because Mayor Roberts has said that CMPD should no longer investigate its own officers in police shootings. Police disagree, but CMPD is the only police department in North Carolina that conducts its own investigations. Other departments use the State Bureau of Investigation for fatal shootings. Why?
That's a good question. I mean, they say that we wrote an editorial earlier today, this week, basically challenging that very procedure or policy. And when we asked CMPD, you know, basically, why do you guys feel this is the right way to go forward? They basically just pointed to the existing state law that allows them to do that and that says if a relative of a victim in a police shooting has a problem with the way that that happened or was handled, then that relative can ask for the SBI to come in. But our question was more not just what is the state law, it was why do you think the way that you're doing this is the correct way?
Right.
And we never got an answer, which to me sort of just undercuts what the chief has been saying so passionately about join with us.
But your,
I guess it doesn't include the media asking questions.
But your paper also reported that the CMPD is better staffed than the SBI and therefore better equipped to provide the timely response that is critical to criminal investigations.
But we also said in that same story that Bob Schermeyer, a former high-ranking CMPD official who now leads the SBI, on the other side, said, no, we can handle it. It's, you know, we could do this.
And it may be true
we were asked.
It may be true that CMPD is the only police department in North Carolina that investigates its own fatal shootings, but that is not the case in the rest of the country. Most big city police departments do their own investigations. Is that wise?
No.
In this error, era of police shootings of African Americans.
Well, I mean,
one thing you talked about, the president's task force on policing, that was one thing that it called for. Putney and different ones will say, oh, we're doing things according to recommendations of that particular, the president's task force. But that was one thing they called for, independent investigations mm-hmm. when there are police shootings. And that is one thing they're not following.
I think one thing that we're seeing over and over again with CMPD, and it's probably similar in many other cities, is while even when they talk about being transparent and improving transparency, it's just not the culture. It's so difficult for them to change the way yeah. that things have always been done. And I think that's part of the reason that there's this halting sort of back and forth mm-hmm. of, we understand that there isn't trust, but then, hey, just listen to us. And as you say, it is a very difficult line to walk, but they've got a fair amount of distance to,
yeah,
to
they
improve.
Got some work
it's also very
that.
Hard for the press to get. I don't know how you guys are doing, but it's hard to get phone calls returned. And yeah. at the government center, that was brought up with Chief Putney, that yeah. we can't get calls returned from your PR people. And he said, well, that's going to change. We're going to make sure you get the information. On my end, I don't see any difference with that. And that's part of the transparency that they talk about that I don't see happening.
And perhaps part of the tight wire that the chief is walking here is that in other cities where these shootings have taken place and investigations ensue and recommendations are made about police changing their behavior, police officers on the street begin to pull back. They don't arrest people. They don't stop people who should maybe be stopped because nobody's got my back. Mm-hmm. And maybe he's trying to avoid that from happening here.
Well, I mean, I imagine that's part of it. I mean, we've heard that's something that happens. I'm not sure if we really have hard data on
exactly.
how much that really happens.
But you've actually questioned in an editorial, you questioned the chief's sincerity
on
being open and
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it's the same thing that Eric was just saying. You know, they say they want to be open and transparent until the rubber hits the road and it becomes a painful thing to be open and transparent, and suddenly they're not open
you
and
know,
transparent.
I think of Mayor Roberts' statement during that press conference, I lean toward transparency.
right.
You know, I mean, that's the thing about it. Transparency is uncomfortable. It is.
Yeah.
But you can't lean toward it. You have to either embrace it or you don't.
And I understand when you're dealing with with the criminal justice system, it can get complicated because you're dealing with people's rights, right to a fair trial.
Right.
But it's never, in my opinion, a good idea for the police department to investigate themselves, even if they get it right.
Well, take police department out of it. Anyone. It just doesn't work.
The truth will set you free, we are told. Is that not true?
And then one thing some people are saying is that when SBI comes in, say, for instance, in the Scott shooting, the family asked for SBI to come in, that they're coming in late after the scene has been already, you know, worked by police, and that, you know, maybe some witnesses might not be around or hard to find, that they're coming late in the process and that they should be there early on.
Earlier this week, Wells Fargo's new CEO, Tim Sloan, used Charlotte's Night Theater. I'm not clear on whether he was actually at the theater or just his image on a screen at the theater, but he apologized to employees for the bank's sales scandal, noting that weaknesses within Wells' culture must be changed. 700 employees were there. Was he there?
I don't know because I wasn't there.
Okay.
I could not.
Why
I
apologize to employees?
Well, because initially they blamed employees. You remember John Stumpf went to Capitol Hill and said these were rogue employees and really this was not the doing of the executive. So they have to go try and restore morale. And by the way, that's another road that will be very, very long. That's not a quick trip either.
Well, they're keeping the Observer in business because every day they're running a full page ad on page 3.
Thank you, Wells Fargo.
Are they doing the same in the Business Journal?
That's a good question. I'm going to have to go check. Tell our ad sales team to get on it.
Full page color ad. That used to cost a lot of money. Does it today?
I mean,
it used to cost a lot of money.
Well, one thing with Sloan being named, there are still questions in Congress and on Capitol Hill. Did they get the right person?
Right.
He's looked at it as an insider. Yeah. And whether or not anything is going to really change with you bringing someone who's been there, I think, 29 years, and they are asking, what did he know and when did he know it, whatever, in terms of everything that played out at Wells Fargo. And Senator Elizabeth Warren is still asking questions and says she wants answers in terms of that.
We need to end with some good news. Here's some good news. The Panthers didn't play last Sunday.
and they didn't lose.
That's right.
Sterling performance.
You reported this week that ESPN, the magazine's annual ultimate standings ranking of 122 franchises in the NFL, NBA, NHL, and Major League Baseball, puts the Panthers at number 3, up 21 spots from 2015. What does this mean?
This is based on affordability, stadium experience, and those kinds of factors, and performance.
But that was last year.
But the problem is, Mike, 15-1 will get you a lot higher with your fans and your affordability and your bang for your buck than 1-5. So they probably need to get busy starting Sunday.
Because you also report that the Panthers are number 1 in bang for the buck. But that's from last year because it was the winning team and the prices did. Didn't the prices go up this year?
Yes, the prices did. But you have to remember, this is relative to the rest of the NFL, and the Panthers are actually not that expensive by NFL terms.
But given the record.
By human terms, yes.
But given the record this year, would we still win that bang for the buck?
I don't think it's going to be quite as easy.
And finally, you mentioned that ESPN, the magazine's ranking of the Hornets at 27th in the NBA due to last year's 48-win playoff season.
27th in sports overall.
Yeah, they say the buzz is officially back.
Yes.
Is what they're saying.
They're up 56 spots, so I guess that's a good thing. They get started Saturday with the home opener. They've obviously already played one game. They're 1-0, and they go to Miami tonight. So, yes, be optimistic, Mike.
And they missed getting the award for the cheapest ticket in the NBA by 40 cents.
By 40 cents.
See, so there's good news.
Yes.
There's good news out there.
We're all happy.
Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer of the Charlotte Business Journal. Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Glenn Birkins, publisher of QCityMetro.com. And Gwendolyn Glenn from W.